Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio Show. My guest for this morning is author Dr. Deborah Palmer Bussey. She is a former nun and psychologist. Deborah and I will be discussing her latest novel, The Family That Stays Together, as well as the importance of family relationships during this holiday season. Good morning, Deborah. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I am doing great, and thank you for the invitation.
It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. I am so glad you're able to join us during this holiday season. The Family That Stays Together sounds like a perfect holiday book. The fact that it is a mystery novel, to me, that's just the icing on the cake, so to speak. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, and that's getting longer as I age. But born in Cleveland, Ohio, and actually my mom was born in Panama, and my father was born in Jamaica. So that certainly influenced my upbringing. We were raised Catholic, you know, unlike a lot of the African Americans that were on our street with immigrant background parents. And we went to Catholic schools. After Catholic school was when I decided to enter religious life and was there for 13 years and left after 13 years, just actually due to the fact of just trying to figure out racial identity issues as an African-American woman, and then went on to graduate school and became a psychologist and have worked in that field ever since. I then went off to do more diversity work and have had many great positions in academia, and now I'm at UMass Medical School as a as the director of vice chancellor there for human resources and diversity and inclusion.
Fantastic. You certainly have a very flavorful life, I would say.
Yes.
Growing up, you were speaking Splangish and Ebonics. How was that like?
Yes, I always, and actually, we always have conversations with my parents, my father since deceased, but my mother particularly, because now that Spanish is such a necessary language, I think, or a great language to have to be able to navigate, in, particularly in our global society. I wish that I'd grown up learning Spanish, and my mother was that was her first language, and yet she was trying to learn English through us and through our education. And so we're also living in the Black community. And that's when, you know, a lot of the notion of Black English and the Black dialect was out, so in Ebonics. So I, you know, my language was really just muddled because I was learning English from my mom, which was really more like Spanglish. And then in the neighborhood, it was peppered with Ebonics. So I probably the reason why I ended up majoring in English in college so that I could straighten that all out.
That's interesting. We don't hear that anymore, but Splanglish and Ebonics and so forth. I don't know whether it still exists, but it certainly was around in the late 80s, I would think.
Right.
It
certainly
90s.
Was.
Yeah.
It was a really big emphasis on that in terms of whether or not grammar, the correct grammar of the person's, whether or not there was actually a pattern for how particularly African-Americans were speaking across the nation in the same patterns, like with putting conjugating the B verb before a B as a verb before, all of that I can remember.
I don't think as a whole, whether you're African-American or Asian or white Americans, we have improved since we are trying to cram everything in what we want to say in 140 characters.
That's so true now. Well, we have a totally new language.
Yeah. So I don't think we have improved from that perspective.
All right.
How did your parents teach you about diversity in family?
You know, that's a really good question, because I really think that my parents taught me most by living it. I call them my first diversity management teachers. They really didn't do it so much about through the lessons as they or taught lessons as they did by their life experience. They had race, friends from many different races that were always in our home. You know, like I said, we grew up Catholic, and so there was also some religious diversity in our home. They were gay-friendly, so, you know, we grew up in a home where that was also celebrated, accepted and celebrated. So I think that they really showed me what diversity was about and the richness and the benefits of diversity early on.
That's very interesting. If I'm not mistaken, I read something about they shared with you about points to be mindful about. Can you share those with us?
Some points to be mindful about in terms of, I'm sorry.
Diversity, what to look for and why is it so rich to be able to be embracing of someone else's diversity?
Right, I think because, you know, first of all, you know, it certainly makes you a better person. In the sense that if you really understand, it helps you to understand who you are, widens your thinking and your knowledge base. The other thing is it certainly expands your world. My father used to have those Lifetime series where they were not because they were long before the videotapes, but slide projectors, the literate slide projector where you put the slides in and get
the
it in.
Carousel,
the carousel. Exactly, the carousel, exactly. And, you know, they would put those in there and we would go to different countries because he would get those and, you know, we'd have that. We had diversity in terms of our the music expression. So a lot of so the benefits of those of living in a or knowing people who were from different cultures or also different expressions and different religious faiths and traditions, different races, certainly helped to make you smarter. And that's what and that was really one of the things that they promoted. That was your best educational experience, is just being around people who were diverse.
That's interesting. I think that children of immigrants or immigrants in general have that certain richness that goes with them in terms of the fact that, well, you're in a new area, new situation, and, well, you got not much of a choice. Either you mix and mingle or you're on your own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, you know, because you have something else to a benchmark against or another experience in life and not just experiencing particularly in America, in the United States, I think that because of the lack of proximity of other countries, then we don't have that, you know, that influence. And so it's often can be very provincial or in thinking or not having that kind of experience. Or even if you do travel, you think of it as just that, traveling, and you think of it as being a tourist rather than, wow, you know, this is actually a lived experience for a great many people.
Right, right. Interesting. How did you end up becoming a nun after high school?
And that is, you know, here I grew up in, you know, inner city, Cleveland, you know, African-American community where most of the people didn't even understand Catholic and, you know, coming up where I actually am old enough that remember the Latin masses. And so we used to just, you know, kind of think of that as a actually another language added to the Spanglish and Ebonics. But it was the late 1960s, early 70s, and that time was the time of, like, the hippies and social justice was really huge. You know, after Martin Luther King had died and, you know, John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, and so there was a lot of just fervor for doing good. And I remember thinking I wanted to choose something to do in my life that was going to be productive and make a difference. and that mm-hmm. would not be associated with the establishment or making a lot of money. And I would put my head down on in the pillow at night and be feel good about making a difference. And at that time, then I thought I would enter the Peace Corps, and because that was also very popular to volunteer and go into the Peace Corps. And one of the my teachers, who one of the nuns who asked me about what I was going to do, you know, after graduation, and I talked about the Peace Corps, and she said, you know, why don't you go all the way? And I interpret that, you know, them being the good Catholic girl, I'd interpret that the other way. But I did interpret it to mean, you know, why didn't I give my total life to God? And at that point, there was a full court press. You know, that's how the nuns did it. They had these vocation days, and then they had a full court press for people who they thought, you know, would be great to enter religious life and, you know, and encourage them to do so. And there were others, many others actually in my class. And some of my best friends were doing it. So so it was almost, you know, and I knew very little about it when I think back on it. It was more like going to college. It was like a different, you know, it was just like a different college. Now, you know, I think, you know, people are making much more informed decisions about those kind of life choices.
That's very interesting, though. I think based on having read who you are and so forth, I think you always have that inquisitive mind wants to know. So at a very young age, of course, in your teens, graduating from high school, you do have this concept of, hey, why not check it out and see what happens and so forth. So that makes a lot of sense.
Exactly, you know, especially we were talking about the way I grew up in my family and the diversity experience, and this was just another kind of diverse experience. I didn't realize, you know, that it would have such a significant impact on my life because I was actually choosing a lifestyle. I was actually choosing a career, not only just a career, it was an identity.
Very interesting. So what was the experience like?
It was actually, Johnny, rewarding in many ways, in the sense of the a sense of belonging in the terms of community. You got to see real community experience. I was in a teaching order, so there was a heavy focus on education. And at the same time, it was also very debilitating, you know, in terms of the adult developmental task.
Yeah.
You know, it was at a time when, you know, your mail was read and you couldn't go home for home visits, and you know, the same family who nurtured you to that vocation, you weren't allowed to see or limited to see in very, you know, very restricted times, and and it was so to master the adult developmental task, even just of financially having your own money and spending, making your own decisions, that was very challenging. And I think that in some ways, particularly for me who had to navigate not only, you know, the religious life experience in a Catholic world, but then a racially different world than many of my counterparts, it became very almost emotionally retarding.
Well,
yeah,
very interesting. So there's no such thing as, like, what do we do about Maria?
I know. No, that was, I just watched that again the other night and with the live performance. But it was, you know, I did think about that, you know, that one that was very, and actually, to be honest, there probably were many of the Mother Superiors like the one in that who really looked at someone and said, hey, this isn't going to work and you need to do this, and gives you that really solid, grounded advice and said what this is life is about and what this life isn't about. But it has its own politics and its own struggles and its own challenges. And that's actually some of what comes out in the book, because the nuns are very real. They're very contemporary. And they're struggling with some of the same issues that many adults, all adults, struggle with.
Right. Very, very interesting. Did you learn something about yourself that you didn't actually know?
Actually, I did, you know, because I came from a household. I had five sisters and a brother, and, you know, my parents, as you know, besides for being just very diversity affirming, they were also one where they, I wouldn't say on the parental scale of discipline, they weren't authoritarian. You know, they weren't completely liberal, but they were, you know, like kind of freestyle, but they weren't authoritarian. So, but I did go into a very disciplined, you know, lifestyle, you know, where you got up at, you know, at 5 o'clock and you had these prayers at this time and everything was very strict and very disciplined. And I didn't think I had that in me, but, you know, at a very young age, because I left, you know, I entered at 17 and and had my 18th birthday actually in the convent, you know, but I did real well on the discipline piece, which surprised me. You know, I had, and when I tell people now that I actually did retreats that were seven, a week of silence, they can't believe it. I can't believe it myself. But, you know, but that's actually, you know, what was there. So the discipline was clearly one. And then, you know, a gift that I got from that was, you know, the intellectual rigor. As I said, it was an educational order. And I think I was able to leave and then complete my PhD, continue on in school and stick, and to, you know, and to write not only the fiction work now, but the nonfiction work that I've done. I don't know if I would have had that same kind of discipline and that same kind of intellectual rigor had I not had that convent experience.
That's very interesting. Well, I look at life in terms of from 18 till about 30, that's where you really learn a lot, because during childhood, from the day you were born till maybe 10, 12 years old, you don't know it all because your parents are trying to teach you the base foundation. And then between around 12 to 17, 18, you get to this situation where you may know it all, and then somewhere along the line when you hit puberty, you know it all.
Exactly.
But you went through the process from 17, 18 to about 30 as a nun. So does that help you define yourself?
It, you know, it really does. And the, you know, the research borns really supports what you just said very well, in because those are really critical years. I think that's why, you know, so many of our, you know, our divorce rate is where it is, because if people are getting married during that time, it's not surprising that, you know, after 30 or in their 40s, et cetera, a new layer of themselves gets revealed, and they and they choose another life partner. But you know, when being in the convent, it was exactly those years from 18, actually 17 till 30, when they were critical to my formation. And I really do think that that time, you know, has still influenced me to this day.
Very interesting. Well, you are certainly making up during those times of a silent retreat.
Yes.
What inspired you to pursue the career as a psychologist?
You know, actually, when I think back and to that, it's, you know, what was the real spark? I actually, when I was very young, probably in the second and third grade, I used to always read the newspaper, and I loved the advice columnist Ann Landers. I used to read her, Ann Landers and Dear Abby. I used to read those columns and then put my hand over the response, read them, and then I would try to say, what would I tell people? So they're writing to Dear Abby or Dear Ann, and I would try to sing. And I think that when I think back to it, that was the time when I was really just interested in human behavior. I used to think about psychologists more as advice givers, and of course, as I got older, that's not what it was more about. There was really more about understanding the underlying behavior of or human behavior and the underlying principles that guide that. And so I began to get interested in the theory behind it, but I knew that a career as a psychologist would also be a broad one. I could do a lot of things, and I certainly have done. I could do clinical practice. I could be a therapist, which I was. You know, I could do academia, which I was a university professor. I could do consulting, which I've done. I, you know, there was just a broad, it was an umbrella for a lot of different careers as well.
Yeah.
And I thought
yeah.
that would be good.
You're certainly made for it because of your diverse background and experience that you've encountered in life, especially I think the nunhood probably helped you in a tremendous way. The interesting part about it now, you have evolved over the years from the nunship and then to obviously a working psychologist, and you've done tremendously well. Now you're into writing. Prior to writing these wonderful novels, you were also an award-winning author that is more on the serious side because you were addressing issues of diversity and so forth. What truly inspired you to start writing?
You know, again, I think it was more a way of communicating, and I really mm-hmm. didn't know that I was good at writing until others told me. I think this is the power of mentoring. It's also the power of the influence of a good teacher. When I was in Girl Scouts, actually, my leader, the scout leader, Mrs. Ford, and I'll always remember her, she gave out little gifts to everybody in the troop, and she gave me a notebook, and she said, I'm giving you this notebook because I noticed that you like to write. And I thought, how did she know that? You know? And it was just very interesting because I didn't know that about myself, but I guess I was always writing little things. And then when I was in high school, I know that I loved English, and I would just write stories. When I went to college, I ended up taking a course in journalism, which I loved, and if I weren't a psychologist, I would probably want to be a journalist. But I really did well writing feature articles, and so and that was about people because you know, feature articles you could focus on people. So it was a way to also share and have conversations and have a communicate with other people and to talk about people and to learn about people the same way I did as a psychologist.
Did you use your writing as an escape in some way, so it was just to entertain others?
You know, I think it was both, and that's a really good question. It says, but for me, it started as the escape part was when I moved out of academia. And, there's that publish-or-perish kind of experience. So I had done a lot of writing for journals, a lot of more academic, rigorous, empirical writing where everything you wrote down on paper had to have a citation or had to have some kind of study behind it that could be replicated. And I knew I still wanted to write, but at the same time, I didn't want to have to do that kind of rigorous stuff. But I didn't think about fiction until an attorney friend of mine who shared that she wrote fiction, and she said, you can do that. And I said, not really, because, I think you have to go back to school and get a whole degree on how to write fiction. And she said, no, just write a page a day, and by the end of the year, you'll have a book. Well, I didn't have that discipline to do the page a day, but I clearly found out that I liked sitting down and making up stories, which was very much like my sisters and I used to do when we were little, because that was before the days of computers and iPads and computer games. So we used to sit on the stoop and just make up stories about people and make up stories about that and just laugh. And so I would make up stories, and I loved the fact that you could make up stuff and you didn't have to have a citation for it. You didn't have to have a footnote. You didn't have to have a reference. And if it just wasn't going the way you wanted it to, unlike in a scientific study, you could just make up an ending. And so so that's the escape part. But I also found that I do like to tell, even in the Sister Nun mysteries, I do like to get out a message about diversity. I do like to get out a message about, a part of the spiritual piece and how that does help to bridge the notion of diversity and how humanity, the struggles that we all have are very real. So.
Right. That's very exciting because it is true. People learn from being entertained. And so your novels
very
are
true.
Obviously hitting the true chord out there of each individual's, because in real life, real situations. And the uniqueness about stories, I find that the novels these days, you have the ones that's way off in left field, which is completely fantasy. And then you have the really good ones that they are novels, but then they are reflecting real life, real situation.
Exactly.
And it gives you the options to really connect from the heart. And I believe your novels does that because of the background that you have and the way you write.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Do you have any authors that inspired you?
Actually, I do. There's like Anne Lamott, who writes about writing, but also, and she does a lot of nonfiction, but she's great. I love the way she can take everyday life and her everyday experience and just make it so not only universal, but deep as well.
Yeah.
Ann Patchett, I love, and John Grisham. I think those are two really good storytellers. Then I like Khalid Hosseini, who wrote, you know, The Kite Runner and And the Mountains Will Echo. Those are books where you can not only learn about other cultures, and I think he writes this is Afghanistan, but it's just wonderful, wonderful writing. Humpa Lahari, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her first name right, Jahumpa Lahari, who writes about Indian culture, and she wrote like her new one, The Lowland. Excellent, excellent books. Now, those are writers. You know, they really do, and they inspire
sure.
me.
Wonderful. Do you catch yourself daydreaming a whole lot whenever you're in the writing process?
I do, you know, which is why, you know, the day job, you know, gets in the way, you know, when you're working. So, I really do have to have my writing weekends or writing vacations because I'm thinking it through, and at night I'll get up and I'll open up, you know, the nightstand drawer, write something down, or have a post-it note. Sometimes I get up in the morning and I don't know what I've written or what. It sounded brilliant when I was, you know, in the middle at 4 o'clock in the morning when I'm just jotting down the note. But I'm in that mode, or I'm thinking of dialogue or conversations come to me, and then I write them down. But yes, I do daydream about that.
Interesting. So what is the inspiration behind the Sisters Nun mystery series?
That comes from my relationship, I would say, with my one sister. I have five sisters, as I mentioned, but my one sister, Lisa, who is an interior designer, her design name is Simona Lisa, and she's wonderfully creative and wonderfully gregarious and very, very different than me. And so as we've gotten older, you know, we've always shared the same values, et cetera, in the same direction. But when we were in those years, that 18 to 30 years that you were talking about before, you know, that's, I was in the convent and she was running the streets. and she would tell people that she had a nun, her sister was a nun, and they wouldn't believe her. And it's got to be such a joke, you know. And she would call me up, you know. And, of course, I wouldn't – in those days, I would – you know, if you got a phone call from the family, it was, you know, like life or death. And so they let you go talk to your, you know, your sister. And she would just say – she'd put on her friend on the phone, and they would be laughing. Tell her that you're a nun, you know, because nobody would believe her. And so she would say, you know, I've got a sister that a nun, that's a nun, and then it got shortened to Sister Nun. So that became my nickname, Sister Nun, you know. Because we were very different. So the stories started to revolve. Actually, I was writing a story about the two sisters, and they're juxtaposed against each other. And then I kind of fell into a mystery because you know, that was a genre that I wasn't intending to start off writing about. I really was intending to write about two sisters and their very different lives and different personalities.
Interesting, though, because your focus is still about family. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, family is a theme in actually in both the books. The first one, They Still Call Me Sister, and the family that stays together is the one about a family, the two sisters, again, who the one, Tina, who's the one character, and then Kathy, who is the psychologist and former nun, which is a reflection, in many ways of my life. They've come together to help their very good close family friend who's been accused of a murder of her fiancé, her ex-fiancé, and the family theme is strong in there, not only just the blood sister families, blood family, but the strong friendships and lifelong friend family. And Kathy gets involved, very much involved, and ends up inadvertently having a patient in her clinical practice who actually is one of the main suspects for the the murder. So it's all, and she's there in terms of her family life because she's trying to reconcile with her husband and her son. So there's a lot of themes, but that all comes together in terms of around that notion of family.
Interesting. How did you come up with the various ideas and the characters in the novels?
Well, the characters came from my own family and from friends, so they are definitely a combination, so I'll go with that one, combination of different people that I know. You know, like even Tina is inspired by my one sister, but then the other sisters there, my other sisters combined, are friends that I know. So those were the characters come up from actually are real people or personalities that I've experienced. Mm-hmm. The ideas, I think, come from the what's happening in the news. I'm the typical writer where if you read a news article that is really interesting about somebody who did something like had a gambling habit, I tear it out because that's going to be one of the issues that one of my characters will have. Or if there is a legal case that comes up or something or somebody struggling with an issue, I'll pull it out of usually the newspapers or something real life that somebody's told me about and then just fictionalize it.
One of the things I know that novelist likes to do is that if you cross them, they'll write you in the book and kill you off.
I know. I try to be real careful about making sure that even though the people, some people will say, that's who they're talking about.
Yeah,
I really
try
to make sure that person has a lot of other things that is going on so it's not so identifiable, but you're right.
What was the most challenging aspect in writing the novels?
Taking care of the middle part. You know, you get an idea, and you have a beginning, and you have an end. And then how do you get to that end with the middle? part? You know, I've tried to start writing now and make sure that I have a beginning, a middle, and an end, because before I just had a beginning and a middle, And then, you know, you get in the middle and you're trying to force it to that end, and it doesn't always work. But I love the discovery process that happens when you're writing because you can't start. I'm not an outline person. I do some scenes I write down. I'll do some, have some ideas about the direction that it's going to go and who the characters are going to be. But it does come alive as you're writing because your characters will tell you which direction they want to go.
Interesting. How extensive is your research?
You know, as I mentioned before, I used to do a lot of academic writing, and that had a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And I found that actually that's easier than doing research for fiction. Mm-hmm. So, for example, for The Family That Stays Together, I wanted to interview folks who had compulsive gamblers or gambling addicts. And that was really difficult and challenging to do because I had a few clients in the past that had, but I didn't really deal with addiction when I did my clinical practice. I've read a lot and certainly had the theoretical background for supporting the work or understanding it, but hadn't had real-life experience with people who were gamblers. And I wanted to have one of the characters have that as one of their presenting issues and a problem around that. And so put out all kinds of calls to people that I knew who actually had practices. I had put, you know, calls out on Facebook. These were going to be paid interviews, and I tell you, it was very, very challenging to try to get someone. I did have somebody lined up, and then they backed out at the last minute. So I find trying to do research that's around your characters and the people and getting to know. You know, I've made many trips to Atlanta just to go and look for scenes and, you know, and describe those. Those are easier to do, or going to a club and getting the restaurant or seeing what, you know, like when I first did, they still call me sister. There's a number of characters or things happen in the gay community. So I actually went to Atlanta and interviewed a number of gay men from the community. So that was somewhat easier, but I do find it's challenging, especially if you want to make your characters real and the situations described real, to get people to actually to interview that will, that you interview and that can tell you about it. The wonder of the internet, you know, now is that you can Google stuff and read a lot about it, but there's nothing like actually talking to people. So.
That's right. Very true. What was the most enjoyable and rewarding aspect of writing a mystery series?
I think it is having, you know how it's going to end, and you know who the whodunit part. And so the rewarding part is laying out the little clues in your writing. In disguising it in such a way that the reader at the end will say, wow, and they can, and they go back and say, wow, I remember this, this, this. So the act of controlling the information so that the reader can get it in small doses, or that you have put some clue in there, that's fun. I think that that's fun.
Very interesting. Now, a lot of, if not all, authors, especially from a novel perspective, they pretty much have a lot of themselves in the book. Some of them, if not most of them, have it scattered all over the book in different characters. Yours is actually confined to the heroine. So what are your thoughts about that, and do you still scatter yourself all over the place?
I do, but, you know, Kathy has become very different from me, you know, in this book, and there's a third one, actually, that I just have notes about. But when we first met, we were very much alike, let's say. you know, we shared the same fascination with human behavior and what makes people tick. You know, our values were the same. We had a strong connection to family. You know, steadfast faith, the love of people, and a deep appreciation for the value of diversity. But, you know, and I think also we were both a little neurotic and particularly fond of worrying. You know, but Kathy had started to have a lot more self-doubt than I have, maybe because she's younger. and she also is very much very much a staunch Catholic, and understands, you know, and finds, you know, a lot in the beauty of the faith. And I still do as well, but I'm a little bit more renegade than she is, you know, in terms of the, you know, in terms of her connection to Catholicism. She is very much, you know, in terms of the psychologist, she's very much into introspection, and I'm, you know, probably used to be more so than that. So yeah, she's peppered in there, but she's grown, you know, out. She's a different person. But certainly, you know, and people who know me, I think they read that, and then they, especially people who are close to me at different periods of life, they still call me sister. They may have liked, but then Kathy, in the family that stays together, there's another one of her good friends, Sister Joyce, who's still in the convent, and she's very real. And I think that people might see some of those others who look at it more as a, if they're looking for a Christian novel, or if you're looking for it as a novel on spirituality, I think people get disappointed. I say disappointed, because the themes are not, you know, there are themes around gay lesbian affirmation. There are themes around infidelity. There are themes in how people work through those. There's touches on the complexities of life that I think happen in just anybody's life if you're fully embracing it.
Right.
And so I say that because when people think about a nun or they think about religious, they have a kind of cookbook, you know, the Maria thing and that kind of, you know, and that life, and it's not that. And so, and some people who have read it who are expecting a Christian novel say, oh, I thought this was going to be a Christian novel, and it's not, not that it's erotica or anything. It's not, it's not 50 Shades of Grey or anything like that, but it's not, it's not what I would put in that genre either.
Right. Well, it is 50 Shades of Grey in terms of real life. How's that?
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
I think the life experiences that we all encounter every day certainly is rich with so much diversity and different people, different situations. So your novel is reflective and indicative of that. And the richness that you brought to your novels are based on your life experiences and the fact that you have this natural ability to just to look at the world as is, rather than from a skewed standpoint of view.
Yes, and that is so true. And I think, having been a psychologist, I do know even the people who are, you know, your most, you know, committed in terms of faith or religion, whether it's Catholicism or Christianity or, you know, Muslim or whatever faith tradition, still have, you know, we're all flawed people, and so it expresses itself. We all deal with the complexities of life. You know, we're all challenged by, you know, the very real things that happen. And the characters in this story, whether there are nuns or not, experience that as well.
Well, that brings us to the family issue, because within the family, you have different personality. I mean, no two twins are alike, for example, because they have their own different personality and style and so forth. So your book is maybe expanded from a different perspective. Of course, it's entertaining and so forth, but one has to look at life from a reality lenses and to see that as is. And so I would like to ask you, in terms of your experiences that you have encountered in life and so forth, let's talk a little bit about family relationships during this holiday season. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, you know, this is a time when, you know, the focus is on family, and for those who have, you know, kind of the Norman Rockwell kind of picture-perfect family, which doesn't exist, you know, it might be easier. But then for others who, you know, family means a different thing or a different kind of relationship, it may stir up other stuff. But I do think there is a way to find, you know, to keep your focus, have a focus on family that still is healthy and rewarding, even if you're in a dysfunctional family. And it is by just appreciating who people are in their fullness. You know, I used to tell my clients in therapy, and I do it myself with my family, is to take the helicopter ride and, it, you know, in sometimes in the experience, and just be up on that helicopter while things are going on sometimes, and just thinking, wow, how interesting is that? Or that's such a, you know, those folks are like aliens, or that's really crazy, but enjoying it. And it does help, because I do think if families, you know, do have their challenges, you know, and particularly at this time of year, and, you know, a lot of people are experiencing, you know, financial challenges or just job challenges or health challenges, you know, it is important to put gratitude in there and appreciate what the person is, even if appreciate the crazy. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
Appreciate the crazy, because it can still be very rewarding.
Yeah. Well, what you're saying is focus on the love side of the equation.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, because when you look at people, especially family in this case, through the lens of love, then everything is okay.
It really
because
is.
Because there's beauty in love. Those are the things that I think, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, based on my life's experience and so forth, and I say this respectfully, but I think the 13 years you spent being in the convent certainly taught you tremendous value of unconditional love.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was the beauty of community, and I do think we can continue to have that in our families. And you put it beautifully, said it beautifully around the love. That's the love connection. And I think that sometimes we love people closely and sometimes we love them at a distance, depending
right.
on where, what the relationship is in the family. And so, but be able to appreciate who they are, appreciate, their gifts, appreciate whatever they bring to the table, or appreciate even if it's something that they're getting on your nerves about, what it is about you that
right.
That they allow you to be more, to be more of or better at or to grow from. So it is an attitude of gratitude, as
mm-hmm.
they say, and it is one of love. And I think families are so important. Even, creating your own or having a family, as I've gotten older, it's, my family in their beauty and in their craziness are just really, really important to me.
That's the richness of the family.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
Yeah.
Whether it's
so,
a two-person family or a family that
right.
you create with your friends, a family of
right.
friends or a family, of blood relatives, it's
mm-hmm.
all, it's very important.
And ultimately, if you really, truly want to make real connections, you have to look at things through the unconditional love lens.
It is. It's true. And unconditional love doesn't mean that you have, that you have to accept or put up,
mm-hmm.
or condone or put up with bad behavior or
right.
Compromise your values. It simply means that because this person exists, because this person, is a human being, and
mm-hmm.
And because I am who I am, I treat them and I express that love and that gratitude,
right.
which can be challenging, but at the same time, you get that gift back a
right.
thousandfold.
Well, you brought something very interesting. It's not about them; it is about you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. 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 When I'm angry or upset with one of my family members or, just spending a lot of energy being angry with them or just wishing they were not who they were or they did something differently,
yeah.
it's just eats away at me. It's like, it's not helpful to me. But once I say, okay, that's who they are, give myself a, give them a, permission slip to be crazy, give myself a permission slip to be crazy, then we're all good,
And then if they don't behave themselves, you have the opportunity to write them in the book and smack them in the book.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. I know, my sister would call me and she would say, I wouldn't say that or I didn't do that. And I said, well, you're not Tina, that's not who said that.
You can always say, you remember that? Page 91.
Exactly. Exactly.
What would you like for the readers to gain from reading your novels?
I would like them to have, you talk so beautifully about like kitchen table conversations and,
yeah.
And the kitchen being kind of like the center of home. I would like these novels to spark those kind of kitchen table conversations about family, about diversity, about acceptance, about faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Amazon is probably the easiest and fastest way, but I would love for people also to go to my author page on Facebook, which is Deborah Plummer Bussey, and like that page. That helps out a lot. I have also follow me on Twitter, I have a website as well, and if you just Google Deborah Plummer or Deborah Plummer Bussy, I have the websites come up. And I also blog for the Huffington Post, so reading those blogs also you get to know a lot more about me and about, you know, the thinking. And it's always an invitation for conversation, so would love to hear from folks.
Wonderful. How has writing the Sister Nun mystery series impacted you personally?
Well, you know, besides for just feeling the accomplishment of doing a fiction novel, and I wrote the fiction novel knowing that it was going to be my good enough standard, as I call it, because I have a tendency towards perfectionism or this healthy pursuit of excellence, as sometimes I try to reframe it. But in academia, you know, you're always evaluated, you're always graded, you put something out there and you get, you know, rejection letters. It's the same in fiction, but I can tell you I wrote knowing that I came into it later in life, and I came in knowing that I wasn't going to be the next, you know, like Ann Patchett or the next, you know, John Grisham. I knew that, you know, this was going to be a B or C. You know, people tell me it is A. You know, they're getting some good reviews, which I'm grateful for. But, you know, so it's good enough. It was for me a way to say, you know, here's something that, you know, is entertainment. You know, I'm going to keep getting better as I write these novels, but it's fun. Yeah. You know, it's just fun to do.
I believe if you approach it from a playful perspective, especially like your novels, and like you were saying, at the point in your life where you're looking at this as a wonderful R&R in some ways,
mm-hmm.
then the energy that goes into the novel is totally different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
What advice do you have for aspiring authors who are just starting out in the business?
And that's, you know, that's always a good question. I did write a Huffington Post article or blog on that. And one of the things that I did say on that was to make sure that people, if you're a writer, if you're a reader, is really good. You know, so the more you read, the better it helps your writing. That clearly is one of the advice that I would give. Read in your genre. Read outside of your genre. Have friends that are not in your same field, because that'll widen your experience and also give you a lot more of life to draw from. I would also say if you are writing to look to be like the next bestseller, learn a lot about the book publishing business, because book publishing is not so much about publishing books as it is about making money, and so that can be very, very hard. You know, so to be realistic about those goals, because I think people invest or they go into something and thinking that it's going to be easy or that they're going to be the next bestseller. And it's, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, burst anybody's bubbles or their dream, but, you know, you're just not going to be quickly the next Toni Morrison or Alice Walker, Ann Patchett or Jennifer Weiner or whoever, you know.
Right, right. Well, it's a marathon, basically.
Yeah, it really is. It really is, you know. And to know that, gosh, there's 9,000 books published a day and 400,000 self-published titles, to say nothing of the traditionally published titles. So it's a very, very crowded field. And so when you write, you have to be, you know, disciplined. You have to be able to know that it's something that you're doing because it's intentional for you.
Right, right. It's the passion that drives you. It's not the money.
Exactly, exactly. Because, you know, there's very few people who've made, a living off of writing. You get to, if you're, the bestseller, where you can quit your job, but that doesn't happen. You know, it's you know, they have to think about it like they think of actors and, you know,
right.
or artists or any other art area.
Very true. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yes, and that's such a great, I love that question and how you your talk is framed around this. The recipe for living I would take from Brené Brown's work on gratitude and the Oprah's work on, you know, and things on gratitude. Mm-hmm. I really do find the recipe for living is having that attitude for gratitude. I think that does help to, that's a turnkey from having a great and wonderful and blessed life.
That's beautiful. And, of course, it's perfect timing for the holiday season. As a matter of fact, let me ask you this. What are you thankful for this year?
I'm thankful for family and for help. You know, we've had some health challenges in our family, and I'm just glad that, for the good health that's there, for family, you know, for my sisters, for my mom, who's 87 years old and still going strong, going to Zumba classes and everything. So I'm really grateful for that.
I'm sure she's very proud of you, from sisterhood to psychologist and now an accomplished author.
Thank you. She is.
What is next for you?
Well, I will continue to write. I'm actually doing a follow-up nonfiction work on the book Racing Across the Lines, which was about changing race relations through friendships. And I did a friendship survey, and actually it's still available. So if anybody's interested, go on, again, my website and click on be a part of the friendship survey. So it's the new findings on friendships that cross racial lines. I'm writing that. And then there's a third Sister Nun mystery.
Fantastic. Any last words about the book?
I would hope that people would, my publicist would be disappointed in me if I didn't say, to go online and buy it for the holidays. You know, it's a great book in terms of for family and friends, for the family that stays together would be a great Christmas holiday gift.
It's a fantastic title.
It is.
Wonderful. Well, Deborah, thank you for the great recipe for living you have shared with us just now and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be New York Times best-selling children's book author Elisa Kelvin. As an illustrator, Elisa had produced over 30 picture books. She shares her inspiring stories and experiences by visiting schools, libraries, and bookstores. Her latest book, Cozy Light, Cozy Night, is the winner of American Booksellers Association Best Book for Children 2013. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening, and have a blessed week, and happy holidays. Dr. Deborah, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again, and have a blessed day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.